difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here again with
Keith Phipps
and Scott Tobias.
Our producer, Genevieve Kosky, has relocated to Michigan, and she'll be back as soon as she's overcome that mysterious bout of radiation sickness she got after her Chicago apartment was flattened. Last week, we discussed 1954's Godzilla, Ishiro Honda's original creature feature about a tragic giant lizard that represents humans' overwhelming ambition and capacity for violence. This week, we bring in the modern equivalent, 2019's Godzilla, King of the Monsters, which openly celebrates that same violence. Flatten cities! Woo! You bite that three-headed monster right in one of the heads, Godzilla! This week, we bring in the modern equivalent, 2019's Godzilla, King of the Monsters, which openly celebrates that same violence. Flatten cities! Woo! The new Godzilla King of the Monsters is part of Warner's MonsterVerse, a franchise encompassing both Godzilla and King Kong, who are due to square off in yet another sequel in 2020. This new film follows 2014's American reboot Godzilla and 2017's King Kong reboot Skull Island, but it also consciously echoes the original Godzilla, with references to a horrific weapon called the Oxygen Destroyer, and concerns about the environment and the ways Godzilla might just be the punishment that humanity deserves for what it's doing to our world. But the new film is also a rebooted roundup of other creature feature kaiju monsters of the last 50 years, including King Ghidorah, Rodan, and Mothra, who all have significant roles to play in the latest Battle Royale. We'll look at how Godzilla and his franchise have evolved over the last 50 years after this.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
What we are witnessing here is the return of Titans.
How many of these things are there?
17 and counting.
That's messed up.
Mothra. Rodan. Ghidorah.
Oh my.
They're moving like a pack. They're hunting. They all respond directly to an alpha. We stop this Ghidorah. We stop them all.
Is there another creature that might stand a chance against him?
All right, guys, what'd you think of Godzilla, King of the Monsters? They're looking at each other. There's this thing that old married couples do that's kind of a, how are we going to address this look? And they just gave it to each other.
It's like, how are we going to talk to the child who has disappointed us so thoroughly?
I mean, I want to be as positive as possible. There's some really striking images in this. I think just on a frame-by-frame basis, there's a lot of memorable, you know, compositions, and the monsters are cool. I grew a little tired of the smoked-out look, but it is definitely an aesthetic choice.
So we're starting this lecture saying, son, you know we're proud of you.
We love you
very much.
I mean, you know what it really struck me as? This is kind of the film equivalent of a comic book artist who's like really good at covers and splash pages, but doesn't know how to tell a story. Mm. Once I kind of locked onto that in my head while watching this, it's the whole thing kind of made sense to me. I mean, this is, I can see why it cut down to a really great trailer. This trailer had me super excited to see this film. I like the 2014 Godzilla just fine. I thought there's room for improvement, and I thought this was going to be that improvement, but I really grew weary quickly watching this film.
Well, I mean, this film really had me appreciating the 2014 version so much more just by virtue of restraint. I mean, that the 2014 movie is so sort of classical in the sense that it gives you just a little bit at the beginning, and then it just it holds off and holds off and holds off, and then you get this extraordinary last third where they really let things rip, and it's just so satisfying. You feel like, as an audience member, that this movie is really playing you like a piano or whatever these movies are supposed to do. It's not just throwing a whole bunch of crazy crap at you all the time, which is really what King of the Monsters is. And maybe that's the spirit of it. I mean, you know, we did see Destroy All Monsters. It is really about giving you a lot of looks and giving you a lot of chaos, and maybe there's fun to be had in that, but I didn't have all that much fun. What about you?
Mothra has really had a glow up over the years. I mean, I got to say that. I really enjoyed the Mothra imagery. And then going back and watching Destroy All Monsters, where Mothra is mostly just a big
caterpillar.
Plastic caterpillar. Yeah. Like a really unconvincing plastic caterpillar that vaguely lunges into the path of toy trains. Yeah, the idea of Mothra as like a healer queen is definitely new to me and kind of an oddball fit with everything that's going on here. And I feel like this movie is working against itself pretty hard on the whole idea of we've messed up the Earth. So the Earth has given us these titanic monsters that are going to help us by reviving the coral reefs and fixing the ozone layer and bringing rain to the Sahara Desert. And oh, by the way, smushing entire cities full of people. But then, of course, you have the whole spoiler alert. King Ghidorah is an alien and doesn't belong to this ecosystem business. And yet he has like magic kaiju controlling powers, which we can duplicate with a machine. There's so much going on in this movie. Yeah. And for everything that kind of worked for me, which like a lot of the big fights did work for me pretty well, like just in terms of like size and scale, I was pretty impressed with some of them. But again, a lot of the, much like with the very first one, a lot of the character business just really didn't work for me.
No, I actually like creature design wise. I think the film is quite good. I like the even beefier Godzilla than what we got before. I thought that was very nice.
The Japanese are apparently mocking us super hard for our fat ass Godzilla, fat American Godzilla.
He's the fast food Godzilla.
He eats a lot. It's just he just has to. I mean, it's Godzilla.
He's a growing boy. You got to fuel all that nuclear nuclear breath.
There's going to be a lot of nitpicking in this episode, but can I start with one right away? Whoever designed the Mothra containment system, I mean, that doesn't even work for even like 2 seconds. But it looks so elaborate, and then what does it do? It breaks down instantly. This movie is so full of that kind of crap. I mean, it's so chaotic. I mean, there's you don't know what the plan is a lot of the time, and then the plan you get, as you mentioned, this business about Ghidorah and it being this alien creature and being able to control the other kaiju, and then you have all these plans in conflict with each other, and you're not really clear what the plans are and how the hell they're going to work. Like, what in the world is Dr. Emma Russell, played by Vera Farmiga? What's her plan? What is it that she intends to do to stop this? Because I never could quite figure it out.
I mean, my understanding is that Emma is consciously releasing all of the kaiju in the understanding that they're going to probably bring devastation to the world and kill half the people, but then like restore everything and everybody will be better off. And there's kind of a fun hypocritical aspect to that, that like she very clearly means it's okay if 50% of the world dies, as long as it's not me and my daughter. Like everybody else, that's fine.
Yeah.
And like there's a 1% like rich elitist aspect to that that does feel very like relatable and modern and up to the moment, and is just completely unexplored, like completely undefined. And like so much, once again, it's something that is interesting and works conceptually on paper and then just really doesn't come out in the film at all. It just comes across as like she doesn't know what she's doing and she's disorganized.
Yeah.
You could argue that that's because one of them turns out to be an alien and it just messes everything up, I guess.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Or you
it
could
always does. When one of your kaiju is an alien, all your plants go out the window.
I think it's actually pretty hilarious that we're like, we've got these like 17 odd giant city destroying monsters. Everything would have been fine if not for that one that's a cuckoo.
I guess that one does throw it off, but I mean, look at this machine that she has invented, this orca, the code that she's co-invented, has the power to pacify the monsters, but she doesn't really, that's not ultimately what happens here.
Well, it's, but I mean, that arguably is because, I mean, there is a sequence where they start waking up and the Charles Dance character, Alan Jonah, just the most generic, I've got two first names, kind of soldier name imaginable. But the guy in charge of the eco-terrorist group that's squirreling her around the world is like, you said we were going to do this one at a time. And she's like, oh, it's not me. You know, they're all waking up. I think in theory, the plan might have been to go around to them one at a time, wake them up, pacify them, and theoretically use them for the kind of thing you see in the closing credits, again, where they're bringing rain to the Sahara and restoring the Great Barrier Reef and whatnot. It is possible that she thought she had the whole thing under control, and Ghidorah like not responding as expected, and then all of the other kaiju waking up at once around the world, like the plan went wrong. But again, it's not edited or explained well, and I don't think that like that aspect of it really comes across. And she, Charles Dance's character, which again, there are so many really talented people in this cast, and there's a whole lot of like, why is Sally Hawkins in this film in order to be in it for 2 minutes before she gets killed, you know?
Yeah.
What is David Strathairn doing? The answer to some of this is they were in the 2014 Godzilla and their characters are carrying over. But when you have a David Strathairn and you're only using him for like a couple of remote reports, when you have a Aisha Hines and her only job is to stand there and look annoyed when Kyle Chandler won't show up, when you have an O'Shea Jackson Jr. and like his job is to occasionally say, well, this is certainly a messed up situation. Like,
he's funny though.
He's funny, but he's so good and he's so underused because there's so much going on in this film.
Yeah. With Sally Hawkins, I mean, that was one of the things that people commented on, which is that this was a character who figures in, who was in the last film and figures into this one, and we don't even see her die. There's no evidence. We don't see her die. We just know she's deceased later on because the film just tells us she's deceased.
Yeah, and that had like just all of the earmarks of something that didn't work in editing, and audiences were confused, and so they added in a placard that said had her face and the word deceased on it.
Sally Hawkins died on the way back to her home.
Yep, exactly, exactly that kind
Couldn't
of thing.
Could she have taken Ghidorah back to his home planet while she was at it?
Yeah,
there's just no. I just don't think there's any good excuse for a film like this to be this confusing, right? I mean, it should be pretty simple.
You know, humans, monsters fight, humans try to stop them, you know, there's got to be some other scheming. I mean, that is kind of a kaiju thing where you have to figure out some sort of thing going on around them fighting monsters just to pad out the movie in some ways. But I was confused by what was going on in this film pretty much from the beginning. And yeah, it never really let up until the end.
Did I miss the scene where Godzilla sits humanity down and has a heart to heart with them about the fact that they basically try their utmost to murder him? And then like roughly 20 minutes later, they're like, hey, wake up, go fight our enemies.
Yeah.
It feels like he's
a very reasonable monster, I guess.
We're not.
He gets it. He thinks big picture.
We're not going to let a little oxygen destroying stand in the way of our mutually beneficial relationship. But come on, I mean, at the moment where he charges into battle with like the collected might of humanity and their tiny little ships behind him, did you not feel like a little surge of hometown pride?
Yeah, for sure. But I will say this. You know who comes off as the least likable character in this film?
Ghidorah?
No, Rodan. Rodan's just whoever's got, you know, whoever feels like he's on the, you know, he wants to be on the side of whoever's winning, just kind of cozies up to whoever the big man is, you know, whether it's Ghidorah or Godzilla. Just no respect for Rodan.
Rodan worships power.
Rodan is the Starscream of this movie.
Boy, I have to say, I think that it's correct for humankind to have a bit of a beef with Monarch as an organization. I mean, to this extraordinarily costly, secretive, extravagantly funded operation that operates with no oversight and causes unending disaster. I mean, I think this is a pretty bad organization.
Yeah, they're not great. And then, I mean, in the end, it's pretty clear that like all of the information has come out and humanity is just entering a new phase of kaiju relations. And I trying to super fast read like all of the clips streaming by over the closing credits, I was like, I kind of want to see this movie. The movie described there feels like a really big, vicious version of Detective Pikachu. It's just like, man, now we're living in harmony with all of these weirdo creatures.
Yeah, I missed all that. I was reading the credits. I missed all the headlines because I was reading like who was in the film.
Oh, a lot of really important things happened during the credits.
I should probably go see this movie again, is what you're saying.
Yeah, you should definitely go see this movie again. Yeah, we were talking sort of between episode downtime about, like, I nodded off for a couple of minutes and I missed Atlantis. And Scott's like, I didn't nod off. What do you mean Atlantis?
Yeah.
It kind of seems like you missed that part.
No, I did. It just wasn't called Atlantis. But there is this the ruins of this underwater city in which Godzilla sort of hangs out, right?
It's definitely Atlantis. I don't know why Atlantis is in this movie, but...
Setting up for a future Atlantis movie.
Why not?
Atlantis prequel. It's coming.
Maybe an Aquaman crossover?
The Monsterverse. I didn't even think about the whole Monsterverse thing, but I don't know.
Well, it's gotten more legs than the Dark Universe at this point.
Yeah.
And if I can say one takeaway from this is, I guess I'm not totally averse to seeing more MonsterVerse movies.
No.
I liked the 2014 Godzilla fine. I wasn't.
Oh, you weren't that.
I don't know. It's good. It's fine. Okay. It's fine. Contrast the way that movie borrows from Spielberg versus how this movie borrows from Spielberg. I think it's interesting because I think that movie actually gets how Spielberg puts together a shot and constructs a sequence, whereas it's like, I don't know, just have some people staring up at the sky in awe. It's kind of take that part.
Yeah.
But I mean, I didn't love Kong Skull Island. I think I like least of all, but I don't think I'm completely checked out of, I'm at least going to show up and see what happens in the next one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what are you going to skip a monster movie?
I'm not going to skip
it. It's never
going to
happen.
You know me too well, Scott.
Yeah, I do. Of course you're going to see it. And I will too. I believe in Godzilla. So how much of the kind of nonsensical aspects of this movie do you think were intended, maybe? Or a wink and a nod or self-conscious in some way? I mean, is a film that really is this poorly thought through, or is there something just kind of like that's supposed to be fun about just like throwing all this stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks?
I wish it was fun. I was never had fun in this movie. I think everything about the tone of it says take this very seriously, even if it's really light with things like destroying the entire city of Boston.
Yeah.
But I mean, I like Bear McCreary's work as a composer, but I felt that this was a far heavier score. I mean, it suited the material in terms of how it's presented, which is, very dark and heavy and ominous. But, I just found this sort of really funereal score oppressive. And it was just one oppressive element among many. I was never really enjoyed watching this giant monster movie, which is an odd thing. And the actual stabs at humor, I mean, O'Shea Jackson has a couple of moments, but like Bradley Whitford's quippy in this movie, it's dreadful.
What's the one that we were focusing on that was just completely awful?
And I like Bradley Whitford in general, but yeah, it's after we've seen Fenway destroyed, he says like it's going to be a bad, referring to the possible destruction of Boston, like, it's going to be a bad day for Red Sox fans. It's already a very bad day for Red Sox fans. Their beloved ballpark just got destroyed, and I'm assuming that the future of the franchise is kind of questionable at that point, given they have no place to play in the middle of a ruined city. So it's yeah.
you're saying it's a little insensitive of Bradley Whitford.
That Fenway really gets destroyed.
Yeah.
I mean. Plus, where's the
a big green monster?
But that's what the thing. There's where's the green? like the most low hanging comic fruit available. There's a big green monster in Fenway Park, and there's never any commentary on it. Come on, it's right there. And the other thing that, again, I'm nitpicking here, but just that I found so ridiculous is that Millie Bobby Brown has survived this Fenway disaster, and she has somehow made her way back through the rubble to go back to her semi-intact home.
Yes.
And she is hidden in a bathtub, right?
She's
hiding in a bathtub. Okay, so all the entire place collapses on her, but she's protected by being in this bathtub. They discover her, they bring her back, and when she comes back to life, she basically is as if she has drowned. But there was no water. It was no water. She was in a bathtub, but there was no water in the tub. So when she does that whole "I've been drowning, I almost drowned" thing of sputtering and having like spitting up water. It's like, where did the water come from? You're in a bathtub, and you didn't fill the bathtub with water. It was just insane.
I can't explain the water spitting. I am not going to try to explain the water spitting.
This is like a huge
Bradley Whitford. I enjoyed a lot, but okay. I admit I felt like he was dropped in from Cabin in the Woods, mm-hmm. and like if somehow his character survived that film despite everything we see, because he's just, his job is to sit there and watch monitors and make wisecracks, and it feels so much like the same character that I half wonder if it's a tribute. And I feel like he's enjoyable, but he also doesn't belong on that team, and he doesn't belong in this film, and he doesn't have any purpose. And it's just, he's yet another like really talented actor who's just kind of slumming it here with no good purpose. And it feels very strange.
Don't you think that he, rather than Ken Watanabe, who's extremely useful, that Bradley Whitford would have been the better person to commit suicide by using this machine to awaken Godzilla?
I don't see any reason why Bradley Whitford's character would do that, since
he shouldn't, but
no,
but
personality,
I'm just saying,
or
I'm just
arc
saying,
whatsoever.
I'm just
suggesting,
saying, like, they should, you know, recognize that Ken Watanabe is somebody we're going to want to see more of.
That you're just going to want to keep. I mean, yes. if we're going to be that way about it, I kind of feel like Aisha Hines' character, who appears to be like a very serious woman who's very accomplished and takes her duty seriously, might have been a better character for that. I'm not sure where she goes. I lost track of a lot of the characters in this film. And you know who I didn't lose track of? Was Kyle Chandler, who spends most of the movie just being an immense, annoying asshole.
Yeah, I love Kyle Chandler, but you're not wrong about him in this movie.
He's a less than great performer.
A really good performer. He's incredible. A really good actor, but like what this movie gives him is basically, you know, shut up, I'm not listening to you, I'm just screaming at everybody over and over about how these things need to die. So it's a big transition when he decides they don't need to die, but like the scene where they bring him in to help consult on finding his wife, and he just screams down an entire briefing, and they all just kind of stand there sheepishly and let him like yell at them. It went nowhere. It had no purpose except to remind us for the 37th time that he deeply resents Godzilla. And it stopped them in the middle of delivering exposition that I wasn't enjoying, but that we theoretically needed. And he does it over and over. He's playing The Rock in San Andreas. He's playing that character who's just like, all that matters is my wife and kid, and I don't care if everybody else here dies. My purpose is to just scream meaninglessly about like how much I hate everything that is not my wife who betrayed me and left me to die, and my weirdly precocious kid who can survive any amount of stuff except possibly a small amount of water in the mouth.
Well, she can always find a bathtub. That's like her special skill.
So I've got the ultimate Godzilla King of the Monsters challenge for you. Explain Zhang Ziyi in this movie, in her, I mean, you might know this more because there's a connection to Mothra, mm-hmm. and that I think is rooted deeply into the series, that it isn't really that.
Well, I can explain Zhang Ziyi. Is, I think, you know, you can appeal to the Chinese box office if she's in it. But are you talking about the fact that you see that she has a twin at some point?
All this connection to Mothra.
In the original Mothra, Mothra has these twin girls who are like this otherworldly, you know, supernatural creature. I forget what exactly they are, but
like fairies.
They sing a song, and there's a little snippet of the song in this film as well, but it's not really drawn out. It's another instance where it feels like we kind of needed a Godzilla versus Mothra movie and the Godzilla versus King Ghidorah movies to build up to this sort of this monster palooza, because a little more time with those maybe would have been better. I don't know. Would have been better? Mothra looks cool.
I mean, I don't know that I needed that many more films, but it does kind of seem to be like people are perpetually asking, like, what does the MCU do right that all of these other franchises are doing wrong? Mm-hmm. And it just seems like the incredible rush to get to Avengers without doing any of the build-up
movies.
That's
what DC did too.
That's right. Exactly.
What if you went from Iron Man to the Avengers, right?
Yeah.
That's what this is. It's like there's not a lot of build up. So then something like that might have had some richness to it, like the Zhang Zi character and her family and her roots, and then of course the film's roots in the original Mothra and everything like that. If you take time with that, you know, then that's going to pay off in an Avengers like showdown like King of the Monsters. But here it's like, what in the heck is all this stuff that we're being, that's just being thrown at us, and why is it being used to minimize this wonderful Chinese actress, Zhang Ziyi?
Well, it sounds like we didn't love this movie, and we should probably move on to comparing it to a movie that we did love, because that's always fruitful. But before we transition out, I will just say I did really enjoy the interaction between Ghidorah's heads. I like the fact that they're much like the individual tentacles that Doc Ock wears in Spider-Man 2. It, like, they all seem to have personalities, and like the middle one is the helper head, you know, it pulls the call off the regenerated one. It grabs the other ones when they get distracted by devouring people instead of, you know, the fighting they're supposed to be doing. It's just, there's kind of this weird sense that it's the mom head that's always like paying attention to what's going on.
Yeah.
And like, I like the fact that the three-headed monster has different head personalities. I think that's a good gag that plays off repeatedly throughout the movie.
Yeah, the kaiju are all really well. I mean, that really well. They look great.
I like some of the new ones they brought in too, like that woolly mammoth looking thing. And yeah, there's some really interesting looking creatures in this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll be right back after this break to talk about the connections between Godzilla and Godzilla King of the Monsters.
Hold your fire. We don't know he'll attack.
Well, he will if you keep those guns on him. Let him know we're not a threat. Open the shields.
Do it.
It was with the light show.
It's an intimidation display.
Consider us very intimidated.
Now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. I kind of want to start with what Godzilla means. Like, we talked a lot in part one about the original 54 Godzilla, like, as a metaphor for the atomic bomb and everything it did to Japan and, like, the kind of collected cultural trauma there. Does this new Godzilla mean anything? I mean, is it representative of like the wrath of nature coming back against us for what we've done?
You know, I feel like if anything, we didn't unpack the original Godzilla enough, because some of the scenes that really stick with me from that are the really upsetting scenes of the hospital after the monster attack and how much they mirror what I've seen of footage of survivors of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I bring that up not just because we missed it, but also I don't know that there's the equivalent of that in here, because it is, at least in the broad strokes, the metaphor here is the environment. But I don't know that we've seen, you know, it's just sort of announced as the environment. We haven't really seen any, we don't really see anything that's the equivalent of the environmental damage that's being done right now. It's just monsters wreaking havoc, and we're told that the environment is involved somehow. But there's not like a metaphorical equivalent to it, unless I missed it. I mean, maybe I missed some stuff in this movie.
There was a lot going on.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty shallow kind of like tossed off metaphor in terms of the environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't really.
It's almost like we need a metaphor. Here's a metaphor. It's kind of like that scene where you see King Ghidorah in the background and there's a cross in the foreground, and it's like, I don't know, maybe it's a religious metaphor or something. King Ghidorah has three heads, Trinity, I don't know, whatever. It is. There's not a lot of depth to what they're doing here.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of Godzilla is the center of nature, right? Or mm-hmm. something of being this force that could be triggered in certain ways, or supposed to be able to keep things in balance in a way that humanity cannot, and so it has to be treated as such. But I don't think that comes through. Whereas the metaphor in the original Godzilla is so complex, realized in so many interesting ways, because it's not just about the atomic bomb and its effects and those sort of lasting traumas, but it's also, you know, about the development of the hydrogen bomb and future weapons of mass destruction and how far humanity has gone and could go in the future if we continue on the current path. And I think that's pretty significant thematically, and it's so much the purpose of Godzilla. It's not just tacking on a metaphor because that's what you have to do in a Godzilla movie, but it's like this is what the substance of the original Godzilla is, which is a big difference.
I mean, I do like the idea of a Godzilla that's representative in a significant, important way of like what's going on with the environment right now. Just in terms of, you know, we're seeing more flooding, we're seeing rising sea levels, we're seeing more superstorms, we're seeing more flash fires, like all of these big things that people think of as uncontrollable. And like Godzilla doesn't come around to actually working exactly as a defense for humanity until humanity starts working directly with him. And I maybe that's one of the reasons why that scene of him storming into battle with all of those helicopters behind him feels rousing, is because there's a sense of like, hey, maybe we can make a difference here. And I'm not sure that the fight that follows actually reflects that in any way. I'm not sure that we do end up making a difference. But there's that one little moment of like, hey, we matter too. Like, hey, we can actually do something about this, that's empowering in a movie that largely feels like it's about, like, apart from Emma and Charles Dance and like what they're up to, doesn't feel like it has a lot of a place for people in it. It has a place for people's sacrifices making a difference, you know, like Ken Watanabe's character, but it doesn't necessarily have a place for people in battle except frantically dodging and trying to get out of the blast radius. So, I mean, maybe there is, I do think that there's meant to be an environmental metaphor there, but like, as you say, maybe it's just not articulated well enough to matter exactly.
I think the problem is that it's just articulated. It's not really depicted in any way that's effective.
Well, once again, if you just read those things that blitzed by for upward of a half a second each during the closing credits.
I wanted to see who was in the movie, Tasha. I can't
read
two things.
That's not what credits are for, Keith.
I can't read two things at once.
Credits are for setting up the next movie. Haven't you figured that out by now? Seriously, those closing credit clips feel like they set up about four different potential future movies in the franchise.
Cool. I'll grudgingly watch them.
Wait until you can see them on YouTube.
I bailed on the movie before seeing all that stuff.
Oh, there
stuff.
Is a post-credits stinger where Charles Dance's character acquires, it's a head of, one of the
Ghidorah's head. Ghidorah's
head,
presumably. Which, I gotta say, that post-credits sequence just made me weary, because we spend so much time in this movie watching Godzilla battle Ghidorah with like just more and more human cost and city cost and personal cost for Godzilla. And like at the end, it's this huge thing that seems to take like all of his effort to finally take this thing down. And that post-credit sequence is just like, man, screw you. He'll be back. It's fine. Like the important part is that we can do this all again for another $200 million later. And it just felt so self-defeating. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's ending the movie with, oh yeah, but the Joker survived. He like grabbed onto a flagpole or something. I don't know. He'll be back. Give it about 3 years.
Yeah.
Keith, you had something specifically you wanted to bring in.
Yeah, I want to talk about urban destruction and how it plays out in both these films, which makes centerpieces of giant monsters destroying cities. And this whole comparison section is going to be why Godzilla 1954 is better than this movie, but it is, you know, meaningful to see Tokyo destroyed in the original Godzilla with its echoes of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also of the air raids on Tokyo during the war. I mean, this is a country that had seen a lot of damage and a lot of unpredictable death from above. And it kind of captures the horror of that, of people fleeing. I mean, the images of people fleeing Godzilla in horror have become kind of a kaiju cliche, but it's still, you know, it has a freshness of a lived experience in this one and in the 54 Godzilla. And in Godzilla King of the Monsters, it feels really detached from any real danger. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, things getting destroyed, but you never really get a sense of what the destruction means. And it's, I think it's an interesting time to reflect on how we depict this sort of thing in films, because I felt like after 9/11, we would never see it again.
Mm.
It felt like we could never see a city-destroying movie again. And I was, for a while, I was okay with that. And I feel like it kind of crept back in first in thoughtful ways, like War of the Worlds, Steven Spielberg's film, which was very reflective of 9/11. And now it's, at this point, it's just, well, we can go back to blowing up cities again for
it's
fun.
It's such a sick fantasy. And I don't understand
it
why.
Is, but I mean, it is, but also, you know, I feel like in the original Godzilla, the fantasy is not that different. It's just like kind of, it's pure horror and kind of like, you know, darkly therapeutic or something. And this, I'm not sure what it is. I remember a quote from you when like Some of All Fears came out, which was another fairly early after 9/11 film that involved a nuclear bomb going off in, I think, Philadelphia. You said something like America just needs its head examined. But at least that, it kind of felt, it was a more grounded depiction of that, that felt like it at least acknowledged the horrific possibilities of that kind of destruction. I don't think you really get that here. I mean, it is a bad day for Red Sox fans. I will admit that, though.
Well, I mean, there's the urge towards destruction is just a really primal human urge. I mean, the first game, I think, that babies learn to play is you stack up five blocks and then you knock them over. And like, you've seen the face of a baby just going, like thrilled to death that like you piled up like eight blocks and then they got to knock it over. And then you do it again. You can do it all day. Like, there is a delight in knocking things down.
But what if they're city blocks, Tasha?
God, why am I still on this podcast? That was terrible and you're fired. And also really astute and you're rehired. And you have a point, but like, I feel like there's a, just like a, whoa, that was really big. That was really badass kind of factor that almost has nothing to do with like actual, certainly then like cost in material or cost in time or cost in lives. That's just like, oh my gosh, he really knocked over a big thing this time. And I mean, when I saw the Godzilla movie, like people were cheering. People were super, super excited every time Godzilla roared, specifically the first time he roared, the first time he uses his atomic breath, the first time he, you know, lights up and he's going to go nuclear, like all of that stuff. People were just over the moon for, like, mm-hmm. People get very excited about destruction. Keith, I feel like there's an issue that's just like, no matter how filmmakers approach destroying a city in an action movie, somebody's going to complain.
Sure.
Because there were so many complaints over Man of Steel and like Superman's apparent indifference to the fact that he was like smashing buildings full of people. But then you end up with all like more and more movies are like, oh, we totally evacuated Boston. Mm-hmm. Like we called them, we called everybody up 10 minutes in advance and said monsters are coming. And so they left.
Or they got in bathtubs.
They all got in bathtubs together. You know, the fantasy at this point is we magically got everybody to safety and it's all fine. It's all just knocking over blocks point.
Just knock those buildings over. just enjoy it.
It's completely bloodless. But so then people complain about that because it's not mm-hmm. realistic and it's ridiculous. But like you got to make one choice or the other. Like, is the only acceptable choice not destroying cities? I don't mean for that to sound like, oh, what do you expect me to do?
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, it's a Godzilla movie. You got to knock over some buildings. I don't know. It felt like there's thoughtful ways to do it and there's thoughtless ways to do it. And this just feels like a more thoughtless way to do it.
So, but what does the thoughtful way to do it look like, I guess? Because I just don't know at this point.
I'll get back to you. I'll get back to you when I make that kaiju movie, and it's going to really make you think.
Is it Ghidorah is knocking over all the buildings, and Godzilla is very carefully trying to pick them up and reconstruct them?
Sure. Let's do that.
But I mean, I almost think that you have to square up to it and square up to the destruction and square up to the fact that lives are being destroyed. That it's maybe is a big bummer, I guess, if you're making a movie like Godzilla King of the Monsters and you're like, oh, well, I now have the feeling that I now sense that millions of people have lost their lives. their lives. I mean, if you feel the weight of that, that's pretty terrifying. But, you know, the 54 Godzilla, you know, very strongly evokes, you know, the firebombing of Tokyo, you know, and which was a wood city that was just burned, you know, it's a fresh wound. I mean, this is 1954. So that film had the courage to do it and make it into something that was truly meaningful and resonant. And this is just another example of a Hollywood film that is openly fantasizing about our own destruction.
I mean, that's a really, really strong impulse as well. It's something that we just contend with a lot, because there are so many ways these days for us to destroy ourselves. I think that is kind of a fantasy, is like, just as the zombie apocalypse movie is just like, what would it be like if all of these people either went away or weren't people anymore? And like, I didn't have to worry about society because society didn't exist. I feel like there is a little bit of a fantasy that's just like, what if this entire city was just flattened, just leveled? What if this was all gone? And it's maybe not like the healthiest or most joyous fantasy, but like it's a dark impulse that's within all of us. And I think it really does come down to that toddler impulse, that the Incredible Hulk is fun impulse. That's just like, you're sympathizing. I mean, it was very clear, again, that audience was sympathizing with Godzilla. So you're not the person down on the ground running from Godzilla. You're the giant monster with the power to just smash anything that's in your way. Like, it's a power fantasy.
Yeah.
Well, we talked a bit about the clumsy romance in the 54 Godzilla. I wanted to talk about kind of the clumsy family dynamic in King of the Monsters, in part because, you know, as we said in the first movie, it's just like there's no time for this. There's never any time to explain this relationship or to feel the love that we have for each other. And here you've got characters like just running around yelling constantly about their families. But there's also just this feeling of there's no time to explain. I just need to leave you on the collapsing scaffolding with the gigantic waking up monster. Try running away. That'll probably work. Like, there's no time to tell you what I'm up to. We all need to run in opposite directions. And it feels like there's a lot of that throughout the new one. And it hinges so heavily on this three-way relationship dynamic between Kyle Chandler and Vera Farmiga and Millie Bobby Brown. But again, I feel like it's the film's weakest element.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the idea that you're supposed to care about any of those relationships or how any of those people feel in the middle of all of this mess.
I mean, it's really the fact that Chandler and Farmiga and Brown are, you know, fine actors that it sells better than the Godzilla version. Because at least, as I was saying in the Godzilla episode, ultimately that relationship is integrated into the question of how to deal with the Godzilla problem. And I don't think that that's really the case here. Here it's just more like this family that's been kind of broken apart. And they're all dealing with this chaotic situation in a chaotic way, and none of it really resonates at all.
Yeah, to me, it's just the most kind of rote, fractured family reunited by trauma and crisis storyline. I mean, we've seen it so many times. And I don't think it's just nothing particularly intriguing at the way it's done here. I mean, good actors, not necessarily their best roles or even their best work, any of them.
Scott, you wanted to talk about monster effects in both movies and kind of what works, what doesn't.
This is one area where I would praise both films. We have a lot of affection for the 54 version, with whatever its limitations in terms of somebody in a suit and these little meticulously constructed but obvious models that they get crushed. I mean, I think all those effects within, you know, are clever and resourceful and kind of beautiful for their time and even, you know, to watch today. And I also think that looking at the new movie, that the creature design is maybe the thing I like the most about it. Mm. I think all of these creatures look pretty awesome, and occasionally they're presented in a striking way cinematically, despite battle sequences that often in the way of modern blockbusters get a bit chaotic. But I would say on an effects level, both films have their merits.
You know, I can see getting tired of the fights in King of the Monsters, but I can't see not being moved by any of them. Like, I found a lot of that combat really thrilling. Mm-hmm. By the end, I felt like there was maybe too much of it. Like, if there had been fewer really protracted lead-in battles, that last one might have landed a little harder. The movie ends up feeling very long as a result. But I actually felt a little bit similar about the smashy-smashy sequences in the first Godzilla. I felt like all of them went on a little too long. And maybe that's just because I'm not the core audience for like any amount of, like, now I smash a train, now I smash a building, now I smash a much bigger building. Like, I don't feel like any amount of that is fine as long as it keeps escalating. There comes a point where I get a little deadened to it. And I feel like I got a little deadened to it in both of these movies.
I didn't feel they were particularly well staged in King of the Monsters either. I just, you know, it wasn't incoherent, but it wasn't really a sense of like who was coming at who from where. There was no, and it's, a lot of it was so smoky and murky that I think if I could see it a little bit better, I think I might have enjoyed. I don't know why every battle had to feel like that one episode of Game of Thrones when you couldn't see anything. That's kind of how I felt after a while, though.
I mean, Mothra lights up. It's pretty easy to see her fighting Rodan. I enjoyed that face off, even if it did have a little of the feel of the hero's female sidekick is going to fight the villain's female sidekick.
Sure.
Not saying that Rodan is a lady bird or anything, but it did have that sidekick battle kind of feel to it. But, you know, that said, I think Mothra is an interesting design, and Rodan having that caddish, cowardly personality made him stand out a little and was fun. And I did think the final big face-off was pretty rousing and thrilling. Well, in case you want to revisit either or both of these movies to see exactly how rousing the 37th destruction of a city is, Godzilla is available on DVD and online via the Criterion channel, and it's available on the usual digital rental sites. And Godzilla, King of the Monsters, is currently in theaters. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show, in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Scott, what in the film world has been good for you recently?
I've been seeing a lot of things I like. I mean, one thing I'm sure many of you'll be hearing a lot about is the Scorsese Dylan doc that's on Netflix currently, called Rolling Thunder Review. That's absolutely stunning and strange and wonderful. But I wanted to go a little obscure and recommend a movie called Leto. This is a film that was in competition at Cannes last year. It's a Russian film by a filmmaker named Kirill Serebrennikov. And Serebrennikov was not in attendance at that festival because he was under arrest for allegedly embezzling $2 million in state money for the avant-garde theater that he operates. But in reality, the feeling was that he was swept up in a Putin-led crackdown on the artistic community. There's that as background. In any case, but Leto is a film about the Leningrad rock scene of the early 80s, which was inspired a lot by a lot of the new wave sounds that were coming in from the West. And the soundtrack is just loaded with contributions by David Bowie and by Talking Heads, and there's some T-Rex in there, and it's a really outstanding soundtrack, but it kind of follows the scene of these, there's sort of a love triangle that isn't perfectly realized, but it's really about a couple of musicians of different generations who are trying to be these creative and somewhat imitative rock stars in a very repressive, pre-perestroika Soviet Union. And the film is full of these wonderful flights of fancy where they're out there trying to realize this sort of bohemian dream, and they occasionally get there. Or the film will take a situation that seems very drab and then fantasize a scene where it's not, where suddenly suddenly ordinary citizens start to break out into song, and the world that the Leningrad that we see suddenly becomes like animated, and color. The film is in black and white, but suddenly we get bursts of color on the screen. It's just a really interesting, exciting film. If you like, that particular period in rock history or rock in general, it's a really interesting musical. And I think it's kind of a comment. It's a very bitter commentary on how things have kind of come full circle now in terms of Russian culture, to where these repressive conditions in the early 80s have kind of come back into the world of today, in the world in which Sarah Bernikoff is only just now coming out of house arrest for charges that seem to be sort of trumped up in order to punish him and to kind of quell some of the movement that's happening in the artistic community. So interesting movie. It's something that you can find in independent theaters. You'll have to look it up, but I think it's going to be also something that will come to streaming services reasonably soon. It's from the company that distributes the film is called Gunpowder in the Sky, and they put out the recent film by Alex Ross Perry, which is called
Her Smell,
of course, which is called Her Smell, and so that you can track that one down now. So I think that Leto is something you'd be able to track down pretty soon too. So something to keep in mind. Leto, a Russian rock musical by Kirill Serebrennikov. So try to keep that. Write that down, and I think it'll be something that you'll have a chance to see at some point down the line if you don't live in New York and LA or whoever gets this movie right now. Tasha, what about you?
I recently caught up on Booksmart, which for a little while we thought about doing it for the podcast. There was just quite the pile up of different possibilities, and I kind of messed with the whole deal by really not wanting to revisit Superbad all that badly. I am a non-fan of Superbad, and I feel like the things that I don't like about Superbad were things that I was pretty poised to not like about Booksmart. I don't super enjoy movies about kids behaving badly, about like young people trying to get drunk, trying to get drugs, trying to get laid. Like, the quest for a vice movie is just not one of my favorite things. So Booksmart, despite like how many people I really like and respect told me it was wonderful, I went in with just a little bit dubious, and I ended up liking it a lot. It didn't entirely overcome my dislike of that particular trope, but there's just so much to recommend it, and part of it is just how the two leads, Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever, they're written in such a different and interesting and intelligent way. It reminded me a little of Nick and Nora's Ultimate Playlist, and like the way that film like plays with very familiar like coming of age first time tropes. Here, the two of them are kind of high functioning overachiever student grinds who get literally to the last day of school and realize that everybody they know from their like elite California school is probably also going to like an Ivy League college, and they suddenly decide that they've maybe wasted their youth by not partying. So they decide they have to get to the biggest party in town, and then it just turns into what our old friend Noel Murray used to refer to as Into the Night movies, where people just like go on these crazy adventures, episodic adventures from one place to the other as they try to figure out where this party is. And there's a streak throughout it, like a little bit of gross out humor. There's a gag involving hardcore pornography. There's an extended gag that becomes a running joke about masturbatory tactics. There's a gross out thing involving vomit. Like, it is that kind of film that's just like, hey, girls can be raunchy too. But there's also just a really intelligent drawing of the relationship between these two girls, which is just entirely supportive in terms of how they relate to each other. Like, it's so typical in films about girls of a certain age and from a certain era that everything has to be competitive and catty and about like hating other girls. And the relationship between these two girls is so pure. It's so charming. It's so friendly. And it's very, very specific. The humor of the movie is pretty ridiculous and over the top. There's a sequence involving hallucinogenic drugs that the recipients didn't realize they were taking, which is another trope I don't super love. But it gets so unreal and out there and bizarre and unpredictable in its execution. It won me over. Mm-hmm. And that was just the story of this movie. It was, okay, they're going in this direction. Not my favorite. All right, that's a really creative way to deal with that. And it happens over and over throughout
this movie.
It's
a pretty ragged film.
It really is.
But I think it being an Into the Night movie, it allows those movies have the freedom to kind of jolt you in a lot of different directions at once. Watching it, it was like, boy, we could have paired this with so many different movies other than Superbad. I mean, you could pair it with Dazed and Confused, which is another Last Day of School movie. You could pair it with something like Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
Certainly.
Because this is really about their quest to get to this party, but they just have to go to one party after another before they actually get there. There's a lot of different things that we could have paired it with. It would have been good. It's one I wanted to talk about. I had a little bit more mixed feelings about it than I think the average person. I think it's been pretty very well received, and I'm a little bit more muted. I feel like it's got a really, really strong center to it, and then a lot of the stuff around it I didn't find as engaging or funny, but really worth striking. And like, the film takes a big swings. I mean, it's a very, for Olivia Wilde, it's her first movie. She's going for it here, and there's kind of a lot to mull over.
Yeah, and it's not doing super well in theaters, despite just being one of those like critical darlings. People who've seen it seem to love it, but a lot of people aren't seeing it, and that's probably because it has a really uphill road to drive as an R-rated teen comedy. It's like an R-rated movie that's probably ultimately aimed at preteens looking at high school as like aspirational and exciting. So I'm really hoping that this becomes one of those movies that kind of finds its audience and home video, and possibly that finds its proper place as like the naughty, subversive slumber party movie that you watch with your friends. Yeah. When you're maybe not supposed to be watching something this raunchy, but you're getting away with it. And along the way, maybe you learn a little something about life. So Booksmart, Olivia Wilde, enjoyed it a lot. Keith?
I'm going to recommend a movie for your mind. Well, by the time this episode comes out, you'll be able to read about it in a fascinating article on The Verge that I'm writing for Tasha Robinson.
But I know her.
It's an audiobook called William Gibson's Alien 3. And if that sounds odd to your ears, because there already is an Alien 3 and William Gibson had nothing to do with it, I'll briefly walk you through how it exists. Basically, there were many different screenplays for the third Alien film before the one that we know and some of us love, right? You love it, right, Tasha?
Alien 3?
Yeah. I know. I thought there was.
I honestly haven't seen it since.
It's very interesting.
I thought I knew like one really earnest defender. I thought.
I'm definitely not the one earnest defender. Yeah,
but I mean, it's probably the movie I don't like that I've watched the most because I keep it is interesting.
Are you maybe thinking of Joss Whedon? is he maybe the earnest defender?
Maybe. Who knows? You know, a lot of people had in hand a lot of different screenplays that never became Alien 3. The first among them was William Gibson, who was at the time and just, you know, hot off of Neuromancer and was clearly an important science fiction writer whose work had would be a force to be reckoned with for a while. And he took a job writing Alien 3, and ultimately nothing from that screenplay except for a few tiny details got used. It was going to pick up where Aliens left off. The main characters would have been those played by Michael Biehn and Lance Henriksen. And it had sort of like kind of a Cold War metaphor to it. Ordinarily, you know, when a script is discarded, it's never really seen by the public. But in the early days of the internet, the 1990s, it leaked online and kind of picked up a cult following of its own. End of last year, it was turned into a comic book miniseries by Dark Horse. And now this audio drama directed by Dirk Maggs, who's a British director and writer who specializes in audio drama, where, you know, there's kind of a healthier tradition of audio dramas in Britain than there is here, where it kind of died off when television came along. It continued via the BBC and other outlets. And this is an extension of a lot of work he's done. He's done a lot of work adapting properties like X-Files, previous Aliens things, even like Superman and Batman stories into audio dramas. And he's picked up quite a following. And he does a really good job with it here. It's kind of fascinating to, you can close your eyes and kind of picture the Alien film that could have happened from this. And I found it quite enjoyable on its own terms. It's not as William Gibson-y as you might expect, but it's very alien-y and it's very steeped in the mythos of that series. And as sort of a peek into an alternate universe in which this was our Alien 3, I found it a really enjoyable listen.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. I look forward to reading this article on this Verge. I know, seriously, you've turned it in. I haven't looked at it yet. So I am actually literally looking forward to reading it.
I should probably say it's on Audible. It's an Audible original production here.
Very exciting, and just sounds super interesting.
Oh, and it's also add that Michael Biehn and Lance Henriksen reprise their roles from Aliens.
Yeah, you really should mention that.
A pretty key detail to make it even seem more like an extension of that film.
Well, that sounds kind of pretty awesome. Interesting that that's what Lance Henriksen is doing with his time, but I look forward to hearing it.
Lance Henriksen's also appearing in like 5 movies a year. He's 79 years old and he works all the time. So
I know that feel. Well, that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next pairing will come out June 25th and July 2nd. Keith, what's coming up next?
What's coming up next, Tasha? Well, here come the Men in Black. For our next pairing, we'll take a trip back to the summer of 1997, a time when Will Smith ruled the multiplex alongside Tommy Lee Jones as a duo of alien patrolling special agents. Then we'll zap into the present with Men in Black International, a new take on the series starring Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of all the Godzillas there are and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Scott?
You can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work at New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, The Ringer, and other places. I have a big piece on The Ringer about Martin Scorsese's career in nonfiction hopefully you'll have read at this point anyway. And I have another big thing coming in Washington Post about all of the Child's Play movies, so just for the sake of me watching God knows how many hours of Child's Play movies, if you could take the time to read that, I'd appreciate it. What about you, Keith?
Oh boy, I'm as usual kind of all over the place. Like I said, I was writing something for The Verge. I write stuff for Vulture. I write something for Mel. I write stuff for Decider. And you can find me on Twitter at kphipps3000, and you can collect my clips usually at keithphipps.com. Tasha, how about you?
You can find me over at The Verge, where I edit such people as one Scott Tobias and one Keith Phipps, and generally handle the film and TV section. I also occasionally do a little writing myself when I find time. I'm on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. Our absent producer, Genevieve Kosky, is on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky, appropriately enough. She is the deputy TV editor over at Vulture, and you can find her there. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. If you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. While you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners, keep the show going, and keep King Ghidorah at bay. Thanks to Dan the Snake Jakes for his assistance in producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time. This is a no God's